Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I have with me, as usual, the incredible Jason McClellan.
Well, hello. I am here.
Hello.
Being here is half the battle.
Exactly. On a Monday morning, when you make it to work, that's a good thing, especially if you have your clothes on right side out.
I think they're right side out. I think they're facing the right way.
Do your socks match?
I haven't gone that far in my morning's inspection, but I'm only halfway through my cup of coffee. So
yeah. Well, wait till you get your coffee done first, because
I can live with socks that don't match.
Yeah. I've done it before. What do? Sometimes I've done it on purpose, just because, you know, being a bachelor, when your clothes aren't clean and you've only got two that aren't completely the same sock, but, you know, what the hell? They're socks.
I used to do it intentionally, too. Back when I would wear lots of plaid socks, and I would say, hey, that's a cool plaid sock, but that one's cool, too.
Mm-hmm.
I want to wear both of them, so.
Yeah. Well, cool. And
we're
then
pathetic.
Yeah, well, we're guys. So, and Hangar One now has had several episodes out. That's going pretty good, huh?
6 episodes, I believe, have aired. Yeah. And the one that was just on Friday, we were talking about the idea of space weapons. Mm-hmm. And most interestingly to me, the Gary McKinnon case. So we got to talk about that quite a bit.
Yeah, Gary McKinnon. I mean, and it's cool because really a lot of this stuff, we have so many stories and the best. And I think some of the best and most thorough information on all of this, especially from a UFO perspective, right on openmind.tv.
That is absolutely right. I've been trying to direct people there, letting them know, if you like what you saw tonight, go check out more articles on openminds.tv, because we've got the more in-depth and potentially more accurate information.
Yeah, just go search, because we have so much news. It's just incredible. Thousands of stories.
Right.
And so we've got all kinds of stories on all this stuff, because you and I write pretty much a story a day. So
yeah.
We've been doing it for a few years now, so tons and tons of stories on all this stuff.
It certainly adds up.
Yep. But more on UFO news later. First, let me tell you who's going to be on the show. This is going to be pretty cool. We're going to talk to two of the filmmakers of this new documentary called Mirage Men. And we've talked about Richard Doty on the show a few times before, and we will talk about him again. But this documentary has come out where mostly it's interviews with him, from what I understand, and he used to work in the 80s for Air Force Space Command, or no, I'm sorry, Air Force Office of Special Investigations. And there was a lot of UFO stuff that came out during that period of time, this stuff about Dulce, this stuff about Majestic 12, and all of these, you know, UFO crashes and UFOs, aliens meeting with the president, Holloman Air Force Base, all of this stuff. Well, a lot of it is disinformation, says Rick Doty, and his job was to put out that disinformation. According to him, he created a lot of hoax documents and things like this, and he says he did it under orders. Did he really? I don't know. He's lied about everything. He lies about everything. Now, he also says that he really did know real UFO stuff, though, and some of the stuff is real. And if you've heard of this Serpo thing, which is essentially, he says, what happened in Close Encounters really happened, and it was called Project Serpo, and a lot of people talk about that. So I think what Mark Pilkington believes, because I've read the book that he put out before this documentary, is that Doty's telling the truth when he says it all made it up, and that it's all government disinformation. So we'll talk to Mark, and we're also going to talk to the co-director, Roland Denning, and see you know, what they found out from Richard Doty and what they think of the whole thing and what do they think is real and not real, and should be really interesting. So we'll be talking to them soon. However, before we get into that, Jason and I like to talk to you about UFO news and our favorite stories from the week. So, Jason, what was your favorite UFO news story from last week?
Well, there was definitely a UFO story that caused a lot of buzz and was picked up by lots and lots of media outlets. It's because there's an interesting photo attached to this story, and that, of course, is the mysterious UFO on the trail camera in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
There was a couple who has a gigantic piece of property, 150 acres, in Jackson County, Mississippi. They have trail cameras set up around the property so they can view the wildlife that is common on the property. They always see deer and stuff, so they like these cameras to capture pictures of them. They were looking at photos that the cameras took on February 16th because there were a lot of deer feeding in the area, and so there were a lot of pictures taken by these cameras. In these pictures, you'll see, you know, a group of deer, and then there are mysterious lights that look like headlights of a car kind of floating in the air, illuminating the area. And then another photo shows a deer staring off at some unknown light source. So very interesting pictures here with the deer. The owners of these cameras are puzzled by these lights. They're not sure that what we're seeing here is alien spacecraft, but they're definitely ruling out other normal things. You know, sometimes we'll see pictures in these trail cameras that are cars off in the distance that, you know, would explain lights looking like headlights because that's what they are. But in this case, there's no road where these lights are coming from. They're apparently off the ground, hovering. So they're perplexed. They have no idea what could cause the lights in these photos. And some people have offered, though, and even the property owner, the possibility that this could be a drone captured on camera, because they've said that government drones in that area are quite common, almost as common as the deer.
Is that what he said?
I threw that in there. But a handful of people have offered that up and said, you know, they are very common in this area, the drones.
Hmm. Yeah, it is weird. I thought you might talk about that one, and I'm glad you did, because it is such a weird picture that they got, and this light, it looks like from other pictures, started to manifest, you know, earlier, and then the best picture, the fog or light is very more distinct, and yeah, there's two bright lights that they kind of look like headlights, but they're too high.
Yeah, and really, you know, when you see the defined lights like this in these trail cams, in the past we've seen this where, because the way the camera takes the photo and the way the camera operates with its infrared lights, you know, it's got this band of lights, and all of these manufacturers are, the cameras are different, but they have a band of IR lights, and when the strobe goes off, sometimes the camera will capture that in the photo, and you'll see a line of lights, and we've seen that before in UFO photos, and people say, oh, look at this UFO, but you look back and count the number of lights you see, and it syncs up with the number of lights that are on the camera itself.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen that happen before. In this case, the camera they use has, I forget the exact number, but it's a lot of those lights on the camera itself. So it's odd to see just these two lights directly in front of the camera. And also, you know, and again, it's difficult to tell from this black and white photo, but it seems to be really illuminating the area. I mean, you can see the ground lit up, and this trail camera doesn't put off light. So it's really bizarre to see everything illuminated by some unknown light source.
Mm-hmm.
Except perhaps that UFO that's in the picture.
Yeah. Yeah, at first I thought maybe it was the deer's eyes, because in the other pictures they're really lit up.
Mm-hmm.
And the deer itself is so blown out, it's hard to say definitely if it's looking away from the camera or
right.
at it. It
right.
looks away because you can't see a face, but it's so whited out. It's so
right. And I think the one where they're talking about the deer looking at a light source is another one where you don't actually see the headlights, but
yeah.
it's one that's kind of off to the left of the camera, I believe. But, yeah, I mean, again, just kind of illuminating the ground and indicating there is a light source there, but who knows what it's coming from.
WTF, man.
Yeah, so it's got a lot of news sources, even today and through the weekend, talking about the story, posting the pictures. It is quite mysterious.
Yeah, pretty weird stuff.
Yep.
Do you have any best theory or any other theory that what might be going on there?
You know, because people who live in that area have said that it's probably a drone because they see drones all the time, that is interesting. I don't know why there would be a government drone on this big piece of private property
yeah.
for no reason and kind of hovering low. It seems pretty weird. Weirder things have happened, but I guess it's a possibility. But with these trail cams, and, you know, I've never played with one, never experimented with one, but I know because we have seen things before with lights coming up in these photos from the IR lights in the camera itself, I'm leaning more towards some sort of photography issue here in camera, but
mm-hmm.
that's just a big guess on my part. I'm still confused by the whole illuminated area, and if in fact there are no light sources in that area, what is causing the light to be so blown out, and the deer too, like you said. I mean, there's just so apparently so much light going on in that photo.
Yeah, very strange. Very
so,
strange.
Yeah, I think it's pretty strange and pretty interesting, and that's why I was excited to talk about it today, Alejandro.
Yeah. So I had a hard time choosing a story, but I guess one is really UFO related the most. I mean, April Fool's was last week, so I wrote about Richard Branson in 1989 doing this big elaborate joke, and that got a lot of shit. So people ought to check that out because it is a lot of fun. And then it's kind of interesting because this television show Utopia got a hold of us, and they're looking for people interested in UFOs and the paranormal, so that's kind of cool. But I guess the big story last week, and of course one that's really exciting for me, because I love following this stuff, is Bill Clinton being on Jimmy Kimmel. First of all, I like Clinton's a pretty suave dude, you know, he's kind of a cool dude, and Jimmy Kimmel's really cool. Jimmy Kimmel's hilarious, and, you know, people were excited. You know, I know Lee Spiegel sent us emails. He's really excited about Jimmy Kimmel said he, when he had Bill Clinton on the show, he was going to ask about UFOs. And so you wonder, is he going to do it? How is he going to do it? Is it going to come out bad? But Jimmy Kimmel's just a funny dude, and it came out great, I think. And he asked some great questions, you know. He didn't let him go. He kept asking questions. It was funny because Kimmel's like, you know, did you, the first thing I would do when I became president would run over to the White House and I'd ask for all the secrets, including about UFOs. And he says, did you do that? And Clinton says, well, sort of. And he says, you know, in my second term, it was the 50th Roswell anniversary, so he did kind of look into it. He looked into Area 51 as well. So that was kind of cool, and it was funny that Clinton or Kimmel had asked him too. I mean, if you did find something out, would you even tell us? And Clinton said, yeah, I would. Everybody clapped. Would he really? I don't know. But Clinton also did go on to say that he does believe in extraterrestrials, and he wouldn't be surprised if we were visited by aliens. So that was kind of cool. It's something that we kind of knew in that We knew he had researched aliens and UFOs in Roswell before, and from his friend William Hubble, who went to the Justice Department, and he asked him to look into this sort of stuff. So it's kind of interesting. And then Clinton has talked about UFOs a couple times before, and he always leaves the question open, such as statements like, well, if the Air Force really recovered something, they didn't tell me, or I was told there wasn't anything, but I wouldn't be the first president who, you know, staffers have lied to. So he always leaves the question open, and even on Kimmel thing, I wouldn't be surprised if we were visited. So pretty cool, I thought, and gave me an opportunity to put up a pretty long story about Clinton's history, talking about UFOs with some video clips in there, so you guys will have to check that out.
Everybody went crazy for this story. Every single media outlet pretty much in the world was writing about this story.
Yeah.
Which is pretty funny because, yes, he's spoken about UFOs many times in the past, but they latched onto this one, and I thought it was funny seeing a handful of media outlets and the headlines they would choose. And some were saying Clinton says he found no aliens in Roswell. And that's not what he said. He said no aliens in Area 51. But, you know, for a lot of people, Area 51 and Roswell are interchangeable.
Yeah.
But some of the media people, that's how they heard it, so they were writing that. But he did really well. I mean, I love watching Clinton. He's a funny guy. He was a little less animated than usual. He seemed a little tired, but
yeah,
his responses were cool. And Kimmel gets excited about UFOs when he talks about it. This isn't the first time he's done it, but it was an interesting exchange. And yeah, I do really encourage people to check out your story because there is some good back history there to Clinton and the whole UFO subject.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of interesting, too, that at least publicly, I think this is the first time Clinton's used the term Area 51 because he's talked about Area 51 in the past, but he's also always referred to this base in the desert, this secret base. He's never used the term Area 51 because technically it was classified up until fairly recently. So
right. I thought that was pretty cool, too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, Obama kind of trumped him and talked about Area 51 and said the name first not too long ago. But that's in the story also. So
yeah.
So you'll have to check it out. Yeah, so that was really cool, really interesting stuff from the last week. Thank you, Jason McClellan, for talking UFO news with us.
Well, it has been my pleasure. I'm sorry I'm not full steam ahead. My coffee hasn't kicked in yet, but
yeah, your coffee is full steam ahead though, hopefully nice and warm. And
yes sir, well thank you buddy, appreciate it.
All right, well and of course there's a new spacing out that came out, so you can see Jason and Maureen talking about some news on YouTube, and you can see him on Hangar One, and that's every Friday night, but I'm sure they show replays too, huh?
Yeah, all throughout the week.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to check H2's listing for the odd random times they show it, but it definitely airs. The new episodes air on Friday at 10 p.m. Eastern on H2, and yeah, six have aired, so two more remain.
Jason and his cardigan, and I've never seen, I don't think I've ever seen you wear a cardigan, actually.
Oh, I wear cardigans, buddy.
Oh, do you? Cool.
Yeah.
Mostly you're wearing cool t-shirts.
Well, that's because we're in Tempe, Arizona, where you don't really need sweaters all that often.
Yeah.
Hate to rub it in people's faces who are still suffering through snow. Sorry. But, it's a nice, I think it's going to be 90 degrees today. So.
Yep. It's pretty warm.
Yeah. I do wear cardigans on occasion, but usually in winter, my friend.
All right. Well, thank you again, Jason. And let's go ahead and talk with the Mirage Men Men. Mark Pilkington and Roland Denning. Hello, I have Mark Pilkington and Roland Denning on the phone. Mark, you are the writer of Mirage Men, and Roland, I believe you co-directed, so the perfect guys to talk to. Welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm really excited to talk to you guys because I've been researching this topic for years, and I've actually kind of compiled my information and going to be writing a couple stories soon. So it's perfect timing because now I can, you know, include the links and stuff to help promote people being able to talk to Richard Doty himself or see him on your film.
Great. It's a fascinating subject.
It is, and so I want to get into, you know, how did you all come across this story to begin with?
I think Mark should take this on because I came into it only about 2 years ago at post-production stage, so mm-hmm. Mark started the ball rolling with John.
Yeah, so 10 years ago now, I think, John Lundberg was working on a short film and ended up having a conversation with an interesting character from the American intelligence community who suggested to him that he should make a film about someone called Richard Doty. And John sort of met me the next day and said, who's Richard Doty? And I knew the story extremely well, like you. And here we are 10 years later with a finished film and a book, and it's obviously not the entire story because we don't know the entire story
right
at this point, but I think it's as much of the story as anyone who's not directly connected to it understands at this point. Mm-hmm. So we started working on the film. We really had no expectation of ever meeting Rick, and we had developed a whole series of cunning kind of plans to have him pull us over in New Mexico for a traffic violation. And it was something like this. And as it happened, the Serpo story broke in 2005, and Rick Doty, as well as Bill Ryan and Victor Martinez, sort of popped their heads up over the parapets, and we emailed Rick, and that was that, and we went out to the Laughlin UFO conference and spent a week with him there, and he was good enough to agree to go on camera, which is something we'd never imagined would happen. But as you'll see in the film, he's an absolutely fascinating interview subject and is just an enigma in himself.
Right. So, and yeah, we should mention that now, you know, this gentleman, Richard Doty, used to work for Air Force Office of Special Investigations, but now he works for the New Mexico State Police, so that's pretty funny. You really were going to just go try to get pulled over or something. And
That's exactly what we're
The last time we saw him on a local news report, reporting on a burglary in a diner somewhere in New Mexico. Uh-huh. Wearing his cop outfit, and that's the last time we've actually seen an image of him.
Yeah. I guess you could have gone and abducted an old lady or something and waited for...
Nothing as serious as that, but maybe a minor traffic violation, I think, is all we were prepared to do.
I hope he comes out of the woodwork now the film's been released, because it'd be great to do an interview with him after seeing the film, but...
For sure, I know that's really difficult because he's always been, which is, you know, some of the aspects I want to get into actually about his nature and some of the difficulty people have had in interviewing him in the past, as you all found out. But what are your backgrounds? First, I guess, with Mark, you've been interested in this topic for a long time?
Oh, yeah, since childhood, really. I was a Close Encounters kid, I suppose. And
me too.
The thrill never left me from then. And by the mid to late 80s, I think I was a teenager, and Timothy Good's Above Top Secret came out, and you know, it seemed like the whole thing was going to blow wide open at any minute. And of course, it never did, and it never will. But my interest has changed, has evolved over the years, and I'm really, I'd say I'm more interested in it, in the UFOs themselves as a kind of cultural phenomenon, but at the same time, I'm fully aware that people have life-changing and very profound experiences through their contacts or encounters with whatever the UFO or the UFO event represent. So I'm still absolutely fascinated with the topic.
Mm-hmm.
But I've spent far too much time for a grown man reading UFO. So I need a new hobby.
Yeah. Right.
Well, unlike Mark, I have to confess, I was never really involved in the UFO field. I'm a writer and a filmmaker, and I'd always been fascinated in why people believe what they believe, how people tell stories. And I'd read Mark's book, which I thought, this is a fantastic story. And I was running a seminar on reality management as part of something called the Belief System, a sort of art event, and invited Mark up to join it. And this was in Liverpool. And on the train coming back from Liverpool, I said, well, I've read your book, and it's a great story. What's happened to all the film that you shot? And Mark says, well, we haven't sort of done anything with it yet. Do you want to take a look at it? And at that point, I got involved in Mirage Men, the movie, and that was about 2.5 years ago, and I spent the last 2.5 years working with Kypros Kyprianou, putting it together.
And they've done an absolutely incredible job. They've turned a stack of video cassettes into an extremely engrossing and engaging and fascinating film. We're extremely happy with the results.
Right, that's really cool. And so, Roland, your profession is in the film industry, documentaries. What about
yes.
you, Mark? Professionally, what is your background?
I've been a writer and journalist for many years, about 15 years now. I've written for all sorts of places, from The Guardian and The Times newspapers to Boing Boing, the Red Bull Music Academy, 40 and Times I worked for a long time. So journalism and writing. And I also run a small publishing house called Strange Attractor Press, which I've been doing for about 10 years, publishing books that nobody else wants to publish,
mm-hmm.
but on mostly nonfiction, on topics ranging from 18th century mind control technologies to crop circle making to a recent biography of the author of the first radio play for the BBC and the first TV play for the BBC. So quite a range, actually.
Mm-hmm. So getting into Richard Doty and his character, I've found, and I think reading your book, it sounds like you found the same. What's difficult with him is that it seems that what he says is inconsistent. Did you find that to be the case too, where the story changed here and there, and then when you would ask him about, well, this part didn't make sense to me, oh, well, I guess maybe I got that wrong, here's what really happened.
He's consistent with him. He tells the same story, although the stories seem to contradict themselves. He's remarkably consistent,
yeah.
isn't he?
Yeah, I would actually say that, you know, he's no more inconsistent than anybody retelling the same story 100 times. You know, everyone changes things a little bit just to keep themselves interested. But I don't think his larger story has altered that much. And he certainly, after a week, you know, we began to recognize which stories he was telling us probably weren't true at all, and which may have been true. And so that's a different matter. But I think when he was actually talking about the Benowitz story and his involvement with AFOSI, as far as he was able to, his story sort of stayed consistent. I don't, I know for a fact that we haven't got all of the story, and obviously Rick was just a small cog in a bigger machine, and we just, we know who some of those other players were, but I doubt they'll ever talk, so.
Mm-hmm. I think it is the problem of a self-confessed liar, because we know that he lied and manipulated people. Why should he believe anything he says?
Mm-hmm.
And that is,
right.
that is part of the enigma of Richard Doty.
Right. And then, like you said, Mark, that you're still not sure which stories are true and which aren't. Mm-hmm. But you have an idea about which might be.
Yeah, I mean, there is certain... It took a while, but we'd start to... Yeah, he told us some extremely far-out UFO-related stories, which...
Yeah.
I'm disinclined to believe, but then he, as I recount in the book, you know, on one night out, he told us about handling actual extraterrestrial technology, the famous, I forget what they call it now, the crystal book, I think it's called. Or the,
yeah, yellow book, or?
Maybe the yellow book, but it's a sort of crystalline advanced technology. And right. I actually took him up on it and said, you know, you're talking nonsense, you know, BS. And he very, very seriously and earnestly told me that it was true. And the strange thing was, I believed him. And obviously he's well trained in, or he has been trained to, you know, convince people, to persuade people of what he wants them to believe. But I was ready to accept that he believed he'd handled that. So, and this is, you know, something that I'm sure Roland can talk about, who spent probably days on end staring into Rick's eyes editing the film. But, you know, we feel that Rick in many ways is as much a victim as, you know, as Benowitz was or Bill Moore was.
You certainly, when Rick talks about his experience of being shown a film of E.T. Contact, he looks as sincere as he ever does. I mean, if he's performing, it's a fantastic performance. Other points in the interview, he seems quite shifty, and you think, oh, this is dodgy era, we don't quite believe this. But when he talks about his belief in E.T. Contact, and the American Air Force had an E.T. in captivity, and they filmed him, and he saw this film, he looks... if it's not true, it's a stunning performance. And he's consistently told that story, and he believes that. Now, is he still spreading disinformation? Is he a victim of disinformation? Was he put to a test? You know, and if he was put to a test, did he pass or fail? I don't know. It makes him a fascinating character.
Mm-hmm. And Roland, you had mentioned where you felt some of the things he had said were contradictory. Some of his stories contradicted the others. What are these, like, some examples?
I don't think he contradicted himself as much as at one point. He's both a manipulator and a believer. So there's a contradiction within his persona. But right. I don't think there's points in the story which he actually contradicts the facts as he presents them. It's like he's a contradictory character,
right.
But I think he's remarkably consistent in his testimony.
Hmm. Right.
Yeah, I would go with that as well. Like I was saying, I think when it comes to what, you know, what he himself was involved in, I think his story is consistent. And again, I think, as I said, you know, there are certain parts of that story that he can tell us, and other parts that he is legally, bound by oath not to share. So I still don't think we know what the whole thing was really about. We can there's a lot of speculation, but we still don't have any real understanding of why they targeted Benowitz. We can guess, and I think I know why, but I can't prove it. You know.
So, and I guess getting back to Roland's point, and to kind of clarify, I think, so in other words, you have this guy who's working for the Air Force to spread disinformation, but it's then also strange that he actually believes that there is this ET phenomena that's happening. So do you all feel perhaps he was also a victim of disinformation himself?
Probably.
It's a possibility, yes. It's a possibility.
So... But-
Or, I mean, there's a precedent for this. I'm sure it's a kind of Stockholm syndrome in reverse, where back in the 1950s, when CIA agents were working closely with Tibetan nationals to try and foment an uprising against the Chinese, I think it was 57, but I can't remember. There was a terrible massacre of Tibetans. The Chinese just crushed them. And a lot of the CIA agents began adopting Tibetan Buddhist practices and belief systems because, in a way, they were felt so guilty over what had happened. And they'd also kind of spent so much time with these people and learned to admire and respect them that I think as a mark of respect, but also a way to assuage their own bad feeling about what had happened, they kind of took on some of their practices and their culture. And I wonder if Doty may have done the same by immersing himself so deeply into the UFO culture that he kind of was infected by it. It became contagious for him.
Right. So who wants to tackle this? Okay, who wants to tackle kind of as concisely as possible, kind of telling us, because we haven't got what the story is?
Right.
That's a tough one, I know, because there's so much going on.
And the very basic story is not that complex, but in the late 1970s, 1979, an engineer working on contracts for the Air Force and NASA, Paul Benowitz, who lived outside Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico, began seeing strange lights flying over Kirtland, which he began to film. And he was already interested in UFOs. He was beginning to suspect that extraterrestrials were infiltrating human culture, and he believed that these lights might have been an extraterrestrial presence infiltrating Kirtland. So he went to the security officer there, a man named Ernest Edwards, and reported this. And rather than telling him to go away and, you know, rather than just saying thanks very much, you know, we'll look into it, but don't worry about it, they ended up giving him a grant for $50,000 to pursue his investigations. And so they encouraged him, and this kind of snowballed out of control. Rick Doty was a sort of contact officer for Air Force Office of Special Investigations, who befriended Paul Benowitz and encouraged him in his delusions. And this kind of, again, it escalated. They brought in Bill Moore, a respected UFO researcher and author, who also befriended Paul Benowitz and also encouraged his delusions, who was at the same time hoovering up all the information he could from the UFO community and then passing this on to the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, who were then creating fake documents and spreading rumors that basically fueled the passions and the delusions of the UFO field. So it was a so perfect storm that tragically led to, over several years, led to the mental breakdown of Paul Benowitz, who by the mid-80s had to be hospitalized because his state of mind had kind of just decayed so dramatically.
It might be just worth adding to that, not only was Paul Benowitz filming strange lights over the Air Force Base, he was picking up radio signals too and decoding them. And this was possibly a different element that he'd stumbled onto, but the NSA gave him a computer which was pre-programmed to interpret these messages and fed him more information about alien contact. So we have two elements here, the lights above the Air Force Base and also the messages that Paul Benowitz was decoding.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say the NSA gave him a device. How do you know that?
Well, we've only got it on hearsay, and it comes via William Moore speaking to Greg Bishop, I believe. But the hearsay becomes very interesting when it's suggested that the computer was delivered by none other than J. Allen Hynek, the godfather of modern UFO research, and the rumor is that he himself knocked on the door and said, you know, you should use this, which would be like, you know, Jimmy Page turning up on your door with a guitar and saying, you know, this is what you should be playing on.
He did that this morning, actually.
He did, right? the story is second
right.
or third hand. Benowitz's family don't want to talk to anybody, so we don't. And he died in 2001, so you know we're picking up used information here.
Mm-hmm. Now with William Moore, things kind of ended tragically with him too, because he came out in 1989 saying, "Hey, I was working with Doty. People were not happy about it, and it ended his kind of work in the UFO field.
Well, he bailed, you know, voluntarily. He'd had enough of the UFO field. It was actually he was becoming very anxious himself, by all accounts, and obviously frustrated and frustrated with the response of the UFO community to his announcements. So I think he left the mothership, and I think went on to be a researcher of the Mormon faith.
That MUFON conference is actually in the movie, so we do see a bit of Moore's extraordinary confession.
Yeah, it's an incredible scene. I think that ought to have been the turning point for the entire UFO research community, but instead everyone chose to ignore it because it was an uncomfortable truth to be presented with. And I think Bill Moore, he wouldn't speak to us, which we were disappointed and surprised by, but I think he was extremely disappointed with the response to that, to his revelation. But
yeah, and so I want to get more into your ideas there, because he's kind of a mystery in this whole thing too. It's mm-hmm. And I agree with you guys. I think that this is probably one of the most important stories in this field. But even the old-time researchers just seem to feel so uncomfortable about the whole situation that it does seem to be swept under the rug a lot.
Yeah, and because it's an awkward idea to be presented with as
collaborators with the enemy, basically.
Yeah, but right. The brilliant Bob Durant says at the beginning of the film, you know, the great fear that people who've dedicated their lives to researching the UFO field, you know, to be suddenly confronted with this and to suddenly realize maybe they've wasted, you know, so much time and energy on what was essentially a hoax being pulled on them by their own government. That's a big thing to take on board.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, the thing that doesn't get spoken about from within the UFO community, which is extremely important, is that for many people, it's akin to a religious faith, you know, that,
mm-hmm.
And I know that I feel like I was in there myself for some time. And who wouldn't want, you know, extraterrestrials to land and make themselves known to us? Or who wouldn't want to believe that they themselves were in contact with vastly superior beings? It's a wonderful thing to believe. And more importantly, it's a fairly reasonable thing to believe. I think it's not an irrational belief, but I think that a lot of people, you know, fail to see that their research, their kind of work is being driven by faith and hope, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
So to have someone like Bill Moore say, "No, you're being taken for a ride. You need to understand this." That's just awkward.
Well, and it's difficult because Bill Moore was then very many years, you know, passing on information he said he got from secret government sources, and then all of a sudden it turns out he was part of this disinformation and passing on disinformation. I think
mm-hmm.
that disappointed a lot of people as well.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, and he was part of the problem. He thought that becoming part of the problem would make him part of the solution, but it didn't work out that way.
Right. So Stanton Friedman is one of the people kind of in the background part of this story who's come out and remained, you know, in the field and has been successful. But I interviewed him about Bill Moore, and he said, and I've heard other people kind of talk about this, he felt that one of the reasons he wanted to break off his contact was that there was a lot of dishonesty and unscrupulous things that Bill Moore was doing, which made him uncomfortable. And so a lot of people, and I've seen some inconsistencies in some of his statements around this stuff, and some people feel he was involved with some of the hoaxing of these documents. Do you all feel he was involved with the creation of some of these documents?
It's very difficult to say. My personal feeling is that, and if you look at the kind of key texts only were kind of revealed while I was writing the book, actually, and that's notes of telephone calls between Bill Moore, Rick Doty, and Bob Pratt, who was a journalist for the National Enquirer, a very respected journalist working the UFO beat. And they were exchanging a great deal of information at that time, and a lot of that information did end up in the MJ-12 documents, but we don't know exactly the route that it took to get there. We don't really know who concocted the documents, but you can see that there's a kind of paper trail connecting all three of them to the documents.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not persuaded that Moore himself, you know, was actually kind of cutting and pasting Harry Truman's signature into fake documents. My suspicion is that there was a team at AFOSI, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, who were doing that, and that Moore was basically collecting data for them, passing it to Doty, who was then passing it back to his colleagues or his superiors. That's my guess, but again, we don't know. But I'm not. We didn't, as I said, we didn't get to speak to Moore, so we can't sort of speak for him. But I think there's still a story to be told, and he's got some, you know, I think there's more to be heard from him, and I hope one day we'll hear it.
My suspicion is he's a fundamentally decent man who got involved in something murky far too deep.
Yes.
And then, you know, found it hard to extricate himself from, you know, it's like borrowing money from the mob, you know.
I used to think that, but then when these Bob Pratt files, for instance, were recovered, as you mentioned, they talked about how early on he was trying to talk Bob Pratt into creating a book called Majestic 12, and this is before the documents even came out, and he wanted it to be a nonfiction, but Pratt felt we didn't have enough information to say this is a nonfiction, and they kind of broke off that project. So again, I think this lends to at least questions behind Moore's intentions.
I mean, I don't think we're well placed to kind of second guess his intentions. The interesting thing about Majestic is that they then turned it into a novel, which was never published, and Rick Doty was actually the kind of, I don't think he was named as Rick Doty, but a character based on Rick was the kind of hero of the novel who, after revealing he's working in disinformation, then discovers that there really are extraterrestrials visiting the planet and the U.S. government's been covering it up. So he then becomes a whistleblower and is assassinated by someone within the U.S., a kind of covert group within the Pentagon or the Air Force, I don't know who, and the aliens, just like the end of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the aliens kind of take him on board their spacecraft, and they give him a kind of outer space funeral, which is a wonderful idea, and also, I think, sort of puts you a little bit into the mindset that Rick Doty might see himself as this kind of heroic martyr to the truth. And the amazing thing about that is that it goes back to, that's all very early in the 1980s that they were having these discussions. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's what makes it difficult. And I guess the question would be, it must have been hard for you guys to deal with this because you have Rick Doty, who's, like you said, a confessed liar. You don't know what's truth or not with him. Then we have Bill Moore, who isn't talking, who was involved with this information. So he certainly was being less than honest when he was involved with it. And so you have these two people you can't completely trust. Then you have Benowitz, who isn't talking, and now it's passed. It makes it all difficult to really get in there. How did you, at least even from a journalistic perspective, how did you tackle that?
Just by piecing together everything that was there and assembling a partial jigsaw, and you know, then you can just speculate about the parts that are missing.
But the film doesn't come up with definitive answers.
No.
And if you want, you know, clear black and white answers to these issues, you're going to be disappointed in the film. It opens up questions, and I think that's fine. I mean, I think it's fine to say there are things we don't know, there are things we don't understand, and we put this information in front of you, and then the audience has to negotiate their own way through it.
Right.
Yeah. So,
and there are as the brilliant Bob Emenegger, I think, says at the, you know, towards the end of the film, there's a lot of people talking a lot of BS in this field, and there are a lot of people trying to persuade you that they know what's really going on, when the truth is, you know, absolutely nobody knows what's going on. Even you talk to someone like Colonel John Alexander, who's probably as close to knowing what's going on as anyone's going to be, and he says nobody knows what's going on. So, you know, if someone tells you they know what's going on, I think that's the first point at which you can say, yeah, I don't believe you.
Tracy Torme actually says that.
As soon as
someone says they know what's happening, you begin to distrust them.
That's really funny you say that, because I say that a lot, and you know, we talk about that when I interview people a lot, because you know, I feel the same. I think a lot of the people who I trust in this field are the same. Once someone says I've got it all figured out, you know, they probably have the least figured out, and you're not going to get the best information.
Yeah.
And that's what I appreciate, because it's at least, you know, I think, like you all said, this is an important story, so we got to tackle it and try to examine it to figure something out. Because, and this is a big reason, you brought up something really interesting just a second ago, Mark, is that MJ-12, the big Majestic 12 documents, you know, there's this big mythology now about this, you know, this nefarious group called MJ-12, and there's some roots for MJ-12 in this disinformation. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you what I repeat what I say in the book, which we don't really get into in the film, but I'm my belief, yeah, I can't prove it, but you can piece a broken paper trail together. My belief is that Doty, Moore, and Pratt, and to a certain extent Stanton Friedman, discussed a hypothetical idea of a group that was formed in the late 1947, following the supposed crash and reclaiming of extraterrestrial technology, and a group that was put into place to kind of try to make sense of the technology while keeping its existence a secret. But Doty, Moore, Pratt, and Friedman were discussing this and sharing ideas, exchanging information, discussing who they think would have been part of that group at that time. And this is all noted in Bob Pratt's papers, which are now available, are archived on the internet. And then what you see is these names and these ideas are basically reformulated into the MJ-12 papers, which are leaked to two or three different places in 1986. And are kind of pushed out. And what's, for one thing, there's all sorts of grammatical and sort of print errors in the document. One really key piece of information that kind of blows the game, I think, is when the MJ-12 documents refer to the crash site of the Roswell craft, they actually repeat an error that's present in William Moore's book, The Roswell Incident, and a book which was published in 1979, so why documents from 1947 would be repeating this error is a mystery. Again, what I find very interesting is the documents were pushed on various people in America who didn't pick them up. They were then passed to an English researcher called Jenny Randalls, who rejected them, saying she thought they were a hoax. And then they were passed to Timothy Good, whose book Above Top Secret was just about to go to press. So they were included as an appendix to that. And that was the first time that they sort of made their way out into the world. So whoever was behind them was trying hard to get them out into the ufological bloodstream. And they, of course, succeeded.
Right. And so do you feel then that's complete disinformation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have no doubt about it. Is it even disinformation? As everyone likes to say, real disinformation contains germs of the truth. I'm not even sure there are germs of truth in there. I think the whole thing's a fabrication.
But still, the motivation for it is still a mystery, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of effort to go to.
Yeah, that was the motivation.
My next question is what you all felt was the motivation.
I have a theory which I'm prepared to share, which I discuss in the book, but there's a point in about 1987, I think, when an engineer working on military satellites called Lee Graham is handed the documents, the MJ-12 papers, by Bill Moore. And when he is handed these, he actually reports to the security officer of his plant that he's been handed documents he doesn't think he should have. And this initiates an investigation. And at this point, he's visited by two people, one of whom is Barry Hennessy, who's job was to protect the stealth program, which was then sort of in development. And he unexpectedly says to Lee Graham, no, you know, we want you to keep passing those documents around. You know, that's what we'd like you to do with them. So, you know, exactly to what end they wanted them to do that, we can speculate, but it was something to do with fears about Soviet agents infiltrating the UFO community in order to gain information about the stealth program is my suspicion, and I've had hints of confirmation from that, but again, yeah, hopefully we'll get more pieces of that puzzle will fall together, but I think that makes some sense, that they were trying to see who was in contact with, you know, with Soviet agents. They wondered if Lee Graham and others were exchanging classified information with the Soviets under the guise of UFO research.
Right. And isn't that, I think even Doty explained that as his reason for giving the information to Benowitz was trying to make him think that what he was recording was alien and not actually top secret projects out of Kirtland Air Force Base.
Yes.
Yeah. I actually take the borrowing from other research, but I actually believe that Benowitz was targeted very early on as a useful mouthpiece to spread this kind of disinformation. So I think, unlike a lot of other people, I think the lights that he was filming on over Kirtland were actually a lure, were like, you know, illuminated flies used in fishing to kind of to catch their man and then use him to promote the stories that they wanted promoted about extraterrestrials and aliens.
Yes, that's the puzzle. Why didn't they just tell Benowitz to stop? Because he was a patriot. He would have, you know, stopped reporting this lights you were seeing over the Air Force Base if he was told to by the military. But it went beyond that. He was encouraged, and it's a rather elaborate scheme. So Mark's theory that it was actually part of a scheme to destabilize the whole UFO movement, I think, has some credibility.
Mm-hmm. Now, you brought up John Alexander. John Alexander worked in Army intelligence. He worked at Los Alamos. Like you said, he's well-placed to have a lot of information. And I've talked to him at length about this on and off over the years. And, you know, you probably have also. And he brings up a good point in How do we know the government was involved with this at all? How he seems to suspect that this was Doty working either by himself or with others, but not part of an official project at all, just Doty kind of hoaxing some things. What do you think of that theory?
No, over to you, Mark.
Okay, sorry, I thought Roland was going to say something. Yeah. I don't buy it. I just don't buy it. If you look at, again, like Roland was just saying, you know, if that was the case, why was the entire security team of Kirtland Air Force Base, you know, supporting Rick Doty's operation?
There's enough documentation that it was taken on board by Kirtland. It wasn't just a lone agent.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible that there are things that Rick did that stepped beyond, you know, the mark, that stepped outside of protocol and regulation, but I think within the ground, within the context of his role, you know, he was performing counterintelligence for AFOSI and was working to a brief, was working, you know, under instruction from people like Richard Weaver and Barry Hennessy.
I think it's more likely that Doty inflated his own role in the whole story, as he's a consummate storyteller, so I think he probably couldn't resist the temptation to make his own role seem more important. But to actually think he originated it really doesn't, I think, ring true.
And you see, I'm slightly blanking on the name now, but there are early... Is it Ellsworth? Yes, there's the Ellsworth Air Force Base story that Doty was involved in sort of producing fake documentation for. It seems like my whole sort of reasoning within the Mirage Men, the book, is that, you know, that the intelligence organizations and the military intelligence have always used UFOs as a handy cover for their operations, and Rick was kind of briefed into that program essentially, and was trained to do that, and became quite good at it. You know, and
maybe he took it a little bit too far.
I was wondering what you said. There were documents that showed that he was supported by other people on the base. Where did you find that, or what sort of support did you find?
There are incident reports, aren't there?
There are incident reports about... and the head of security at the base, Ernest Edwards at Kirtland, is named several times. And, you know, he and other people were present at the meetings with Paul Benowitz, where it was decided, for example, to give... Like we've been saying, if Benowitz was seeing something he shouldn't, they could have just said, okay, what you've seen is a classified operation, you know, be a good American, and please, you know, don't report this to anybody else. And instead they said, no, you're onto something here. Here's $50,000, you know, do what you need to do to get to the bottom of it and keep reporting back to us. That was a lot of money in those days.
How do you know he was given money? How do you know? And the reason I'm asking this is because I've looked into this and I haven't found any proof of a grant being given.
That's coming from Greg Bishop. So from Greg speaking to us and Greg's book, Project Beta, and Greg's contacts were Bill Moore and Rick Doty. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if some of that wasn't true. Certainly there are documents showing that Ernest Edwards and others were involved with Benowitz and Doty. But the grant thing...
We don't actually mention the grant thing in the film, I think.
Greg does mention it. He does. I'm sure he mentions it in the film.
Yeah, and I was curious just because I've done a lot of FOIAs trying to find out. I did find one with where they reference a meeting where he asked for a grant. Mm-hmm. I was able to interview a guy who spoke with one of the officers who was there, and he kind of said, and I think Greg refers to this in his book, how they just kind of blew him off and most people even left the meeting. So it looked as though a grant actually wasn't made, but as you all have said, that's the hard part, is a lot of this comes back to the word of Doty and Moore. Yeah. Which is
In the same film, we say he asked for a grant. We
right.
don't actually
we say
he's
okay.
not giving it
because okay.
we didn't have the evidence
yeah.
for that.
So I mean, yeah, and also bear in mind, we were interviewing Greg and Rick in 2005. So that's
right.
a long time ago now. so it may well be that there's new information, you know, that like sounds amazing that you're getting some FOIA requests out there.
Very little. I'll send you what I've got, actually.
Please do, yeah. I mean, I am hopeful that over time, you know, I see Mirage Men as one chink in the armor, and I'm hoping over time as people, you know, in the same way that the UFO community and the disclosure movement in particular feel that as, you know, as military and intelligence witnesses to UFO activity get older, they will kind of tell the truth about their encounters. I'm hoping we'll have the inverse, where the Mirage Men will, you know, as they get older, will start to talk about their roles in perpetuating and shaping the UFO mythology. So, you know.
Right.
But as to whether there's documentation, I suspect there won't be a whole lot, but I would think that certainly a lot of what was going on with contacts between Rick and Benowitz and others won't be documented, because that was just, you know, people meeting and talking and sharing information.
Right. And you know, that's one great thing about what you guys have done, in that you got at least interviews with Doty, because some of the difficulty has been in the past where people have said, well, you said X in this interview, but now you're saying something different. And he will often say, well, even with Bishop's book, oh, well, that's not accurate. He misquoted mm-hmm. me. That wasn't the right information. But, of course, now you've got him on film directly saying some of these things. So at least for those pieces, he won't be able to deny at least that he said those things.
No, and he was clearly, you know, being very, very careful about what he would say. There was a huge amount that he said off camera that he wouldn't say on camera. And, you know, he's a smart guy. He's being... No, he knows what he can say and what he can't say.
So, essentially, I mean, what this all comes down to is that this film makes a strong argument that a lot of the mythology that comes in, that is part of the UFO field, stems from Richard Doty himself, actually, and his involvement, but from either... most likely a Air Force or some sort of disinformation campaign.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think one thing we should make clear is people have sort of commented that we're trying to say all UFOs are part of government disinformation campaign. The film doesn't say that. The film takes this particular story and spins out from that story. It's not a statement about UFOs in general.
No, UFOs are real. We know that. People see them every day all over the world. That's not what we're out to dismiss. We're just... Yes, taking a particular strand of the mythology.
I mean, we've been accused of being government agents. I mean, probably by people who haven't actually seen the movie, but that we're working for MI5 or MI6 or the FBI, and we're spreading more disinformation. Of course, we're not.
Well,
but also don't. Well, you have to trust us. Why should you trust us?
No, I trust you. I'm just saying that if you do anything of significant in this field, you're going to get accused of being working for the government. So that's hard to avoid.
If we were working for the government, we'd have been given a bigger budget to make the film.
Right. And so, and I want to ask, do you bring up Dulce at all?
Oh yeah. We've shot in Dulce. We spend a lot of time with Gabe Valdez, who's very sadly passed on since we finished filming. We shoot out in Dulce, and we talk a lot to Linda Moulton Howe about her involvement in the story. So, yeah, that's all in there as well.
Yeah.
So even though you're not calling in question, of course, the whole entire UFO field, but at least things like Dulce and Majestic 12 are mythologies that stem from disinformation.
Yes.
And, you know, one other thought is, you know, what's significant is that even if John Alexander is correct and Richard Doty was not doing this as an official part of his official duties, he was... during that time, an OSI agent. So
absolutely.
How could the Air Force's own employee be doing this sort of stuff for so many years without them knowing? I think that's one of the other really interesting questions.
I'm sure he was sanctioned by higher figures within the security forces.
Yeah, I agree. I just think, like we were saying earlier, he may have overstepped the mark, but what he was doing was part of a sanctioned program. And he says as much in the film, but I think that is the case.
Have you had any sort of official Air Force response or...
No. When the book came out, I had a couple of interesting emails from people saying they knew what was going on and that we were looking in the right places, but nothing beyond that. Mm. And we tried, when we were researching the film, we tried to contact people like Barry Hennessy and Richard Weaver, who were more senior in AFOSI and who were part of the same program, but we were rudely rebuffed, to say the least. So, you know, it's their job not to talk about these things, you know, and it's unfair for us to expect them to do so. It's not reasonable.
So you all live in the UK?
Yes.
So it would be wonderful, you know, we'll have to work it out, or at least we scream the film at our next UFO Congress. I'm not sure if you're aware, we have pretty much the biggest UFO conference out here in the Phoenix area that we do every spring, so...
We would absolutely love that.
Yeah.
That'd be wonderful. Yeah. Please do. And if any of us can come, we certainly will be there.
Well, thank you guys so much. Really interesting. People have to look at this. I think a lot of people still want to kind of bury their head in the sand over this whole situation. But, of course, that's not something you can do if you're really searching for the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you to Mark and to Roland. That was a lot of fun. And actually, you can watch their documentary on openminds.tv. If you go to our webpage and you look on the right-hand side, you'll see a link, a big photo of Richard Doty's face there and the words Mirage Men. You see the DVD cover. Click Watch Now and you'll be able to watch it. You can watch it online for like $7.50. You could also purchase it from that link. So go to openminds.tv to watch it. To find out more about the movie, you can go to miragemen.com. That is miragemen.com to see some more about the movie and some of the awards it's won at some film festivals and stuff like that. So that's kind of cool. So really interesting stuff. And look for more on Richard Doty on our website coming up soon. I mean, if you got our magazine, like I talked about, you probably saw I did the FOIA request to get some information on him, and I'm working right now on a video and a lot more stuff to post in the near future about my FOIAs and some of the other investigation I've done, because I've been looking into this for months and months, if not years, really. So check out openminds.tv for more. Check out miragemen.com. And then also check out our YouTube to see Jason and Maureen doing Spacing Out. And then check out the front page of our website for more UFO news on a daily basis. I want to thank Caleb Hanks for the music. He does the opening music and the close. And like I promised you all, I've been playing some of Caleb's tunes end the show, and we're going to do that again. This is again from his EP, The Clerk Chronicles, and you can just look up The Clerk, Caleb Hanks, Google that, and you'll be able to download this music for free. I recommend you do it because it's awesome stuff. I really love this music. I find myself listening to it, you know, while I'm driving around town and stuff. But this is a song called Echoes. This is actually one of my favorite songs, maybe even my favorite song. So thank you all so much for listening. Be sure to join us next week. We will be back again. And you guys have a great week. Adios, muchachos.
right.